Chapter 11. Teddy. September 1871, Chicago. I think I am getting better at bookkeeping. At the start, I thought, heck, this bookkeeping lark sure ain't for me. But that may have been my nerves talking, because Mr. Weir says he reckons I was born to it. Says I'm mighty good at it, and he's the best woman bookkeeper he's ever had. The only one, of course, for am I the first that we know of. I'd like to go back and show that old school teacher of mine just how well I'm doing in Mr. Weir's booming store and all the cash coming, my responsibility. And bonds, too. I deal with all the paper. There are a few others I'd like to show, too. Stepmother, for instance, and my poor dead mother. Not that I believe in ghosts, but if she'd like to come back just for a minute to see how fast I can count up a pile of small bills, well, she'd be mighty proud, I reckon. When I look back, I can see how far along I've come, because I really did find it difficult at first, but I suppose with Mr. Weir himself showing me his techniques when it comes to dealing with cash and the big, large banknotes, it all helped. He says I am a fast learner. But I knew that anyways. Yesterday, three boys were staring in the window, pointing and drawing a crowd. I looked around to see, was there a bird or something flown into the store? But I couldn't see anything, and a customer came in and said the boys were staring at me, as the first woman bookkeeper they ever saw. Well, yes, it sure is unusual for a young woman like me to be working a job like this, and I don't know of any other woman around who worked in an office like I do, but I suppose I was always a bit unusual, so Papa said, all these years. I got a letter from Boston yesterday to report that poor Papa hasn't been doing so well lately and has moved back to the old homestead in North Sandwich for the good air. He caught a cold 2 months ago, and it's sat right on his chest, and his breathing is getting worse and worse, and he hasn't energy even to get out of bed. Stepmother wrote that it was her idea to send Papa, but I'm not sure if she sent him or if he sent himself, as I can't imagine it must have been much fun having stepmother fussing and being trapped between the sheets all day. Heck, it'd be worth dying just to get away from her. But I shouldn't think like that. I worry for Papa. Uncle came by the store the other day and said he'd also heard that Papa was under the weather, and for a big strapping man like Papa, well, I guess he was worried too. Auntie was asking after me. She likes that I'm nearby in the city now, though I rarely see her, just the odd time when she comes to town for tea, and Mr. Weir says it's all right for me to go off for half an hour, and then we get to catching up. She says I'm getting to be a fine young woman, though my manners still leave a little to be desired, and she says I could very much improve how I talk, as I sound more like a cattleman than a refined young office lady. Office lady. I sure do like the sound of that. Mr. Weir pays me well, but I don't rightly know what to do with the money, for I have everything a young woman requires, and last year I bought a second dress, which I wear while my other is laundered and in consequence. I don't really have much need for anything else, seen as my bed and board are already covered by Mr. Weir, who pays my landlady. A few months back, thinking on this large sum I'd saved up, I decided to invest some into George's potato merchanting. Not that he asked for it, but it was obvious to me that it was good business, for he was buying in a large load of potatoes, and when I asked him what he could make were he to double the load, it turned out he could triple his profit, for the costs were in the transport anyway. So I gave him enough to double the load, and rightly so, it was a great success, and I got back triple what I'd lent. He says I'm a very clever young woman. But business is awful easy sometimes, I reckon. And people sure do love potatoes, especially those Irish and Polish immigrants who seem to make great stews with them or just boil them up straight. A customer told me that in some parts of Ireland the diet is only potatoes, nothing else at all, and with so many Irish in the city, the potatoes always sell. George likes to buy round Jackson white potatoes, as they're considered premium, as the calicoes often have a streak of red or blue in them or come long in shape, but the Irish still buy them anyways. George has gone out for a fresh load and is due back next week with the new haul, in which I've invested again. I've missed him while he's away, more than I'd like to admit. He's a good friend. He knows me very well, though I've set him straight on any nonsense. Men sure do like to put it on sometimes. What a palaver this week has been! I feel sick to my stomach over it all. One of the worst few days I've had since I've come to Chicago to work for Mr. Weir. It all started with this lady, a widow, a very refined woman, southerner, pretty, with blonde curls around her face, by the name of Mrs. Joubert. It was no secret that Mr. Weir had taken a shine to her and her 5-year-old little girl. He'd been in the store the first day she came in and had ended up serving her himself, for he still likes to work the floor from time to time to keep an eye on things and converse with the customers, and they love him for it, too. Well, she came in that day, and of course Mr. Weir, always having an eye for a pretty lady, fussed and fawned over her, and that very week he took her to tea, and the next week too. We started calling her Juliet, for Mr. Weir was Romeo. And Mr. Weir was going around with a big smile on his face like a soft puppy. We could all tell, the way things were going, that if the lady stuck around, it wouldn't be long before Mr. Weir would be fixing to ask for her hand, as he'd already told George that she was the type of woman you wanted to be pouring your coffee in the morning. On Monday, I was covering lunch hour, which I do most days, and I don't mind, for it takes me out of the office, which doesn't have a window and can get hot and stuffy, and who came in only Mrs. Southern Bell herself. She was buying up quite a basket of goods, Chinese tea, pounds of sugar, bars of the expensive chocolate imported from Paris. When I added it all up, she handed me a $5 bill, and as soon as it landed in my palm, I knew that it was counterfeit. I held it up to the light and pronounced my assessment, barely thinking who was in front of me, for I know a counterfeit when I see one, and the words came tumbling out. "I beg your pardon," said Mrs. Joubert, her voice all high-pitched and indignant. I ran my hand over the note and took a real good look at it again, for I wanted to be sure that I wasn't mistaken. But in the same way as you know your own signature, that if someone else wrote it in handwriting just like your own, you could tell as soon as you saw it that it wasn't yours. For the capital letters might look like yours, and the small letters might look like yours, but taken together, by the general appearance of the whole, you'd just know that you never wrote it. Mrs. Joubert, which I always thought was far too fancy a name for her, took the note back and said she'd been given it as change in the large dry goods store up the street, and I told her she should return it, for she had surely been swindled, albeit, I suspected, by accident. Duly, Mrs. Joubert left the store, her basket of goods sitting on the counter. When P.B. Weir heard the story, he was very angry with me and said that I had embarrassed the lady. He said that even if the note were counterfeit, which he assured me it wasn't, as Mrs. Joubert had given him the note when they'd met for their tea later that day and he had declared it to be solid, he said I should have let her take the goods and he would have dealt with it afterwards, for Mrs. Joubert was a fine lady and I had made her to feel like a criminal. I blushed crimson as he berated me in the office and went about my day afterwards feeling sick to my stomach. Never before had I gotten in such trouble. Well, of course, I have gotten in trouble before with Papa, but nothing felt as bad as this. I felt I had let Mr. Weir down terribly and made a fool of myself, all the while wondering what else I could have done, for I thought had I taken in a false note, it would have been a blow to the business. How could I have made such a mistake? I was sure the note was counterfeit. Over the next few days, as I was doing the books, I did in fact find some counterfeit notes, 2 $20 bills. I spoke with the cashiers, who remembered that they'd come from a man who had come in twice that week to buy something very small, only for 50 cents, and each time declared he had only a large note, and they duly took it and gave him change of a $10 and $5 note and the rest in coins. I didn't bring the issue to Mrs. Weir. I didn't bring the issue to Mr. Weir while I tried to decide what to be done, but warned the cashiers to call me immediately should the man come in again. I had a plan that I would detain him long enough for the police to be called so that he could be arrested. I just wasn't sure that he would come back again, seeing as he'd been brave, or stupid enough, to come in 2 times already. When I got a knock to my office the next day and was called to come out by Albert, who is the only one with half a brain, I sometimes think, behind those counters, I was sure the man had come back, but instead I found 2 detectives who informed me they had arrested the man for counterfeiting and wanted to know had we had any issues with counterfeit money in the store. I was only too glad to tell them we'd been shortchanged to the tune of $40, and when I told them I had also been handed a $5 note, which I had my suspicion about, they were very eager to know by whom. My nerves rattled as I told them about the Southern widow, as though Mr. Weir was standing behind me hearing every word I said, but I knew it was the right thing to do, especially as they had asked me directly if we'd had any other counterfeiting attempts. Their eyes widened when I told them of Mrs. Joubert. They thanked me profusely for my troubles and left with Mrs. Joubert's address, for I knew where she lived on account of Mr. Weir sending a red rose to her house every Monday after their Sunday jaunt, which he enjoyed ever so much. I felt terrible, like a spy, and I wondered just how in the world I was going to tell Mr. Weir of all the goings-on and my betrayal, but as it turned out, in the end, I didn't need to, for it was he who came to me to tell me the most dramatic news, that Mrs. Joubert had been arrested fleeing the city, her bags packed to the hilt with goods she'd been buying all over town. For Mrs. Joubert was in on the whole ruse, and she wasn't called Mrs. Joubert at all, but Mrs. Ruiz, and she was married to the Mexican man that had passed off the $20 bills, a known counterfeiter and criminal who had just been let out of jail. Thanks to the address I'd given, they were able to search the house and found piles of ash in the sheet iron stove with some scraps left showing they'd been burning counterfeit cash and providing enough evidence to charge Mrs. Ruiz herself. Well, I never. The Southern Belle, a cold, hard criminal, and married, and not a widow at all. I did think the child she had was rather dark-looking. And me, my nose as keen as a bloodhound, sniffing out trouble, although no one could see it at the time. Mr. Weir was heart-sore and sorry and had a basket of fruit sent to my room as an apology. I didn't need an apology, though. What I needed was to earn Mr. Weir's trust again, his goodwill and his knowledge that I would never, ever do anything to harm the store or him. I love working at P.B. Weir's, and I love being a bookkeeper. As happy as I felt outdoors in coveralls working Uncle and Auntie's farm, I'd say I'm the happiest now in my whole long 17 years. I hope nothing as bad as that episode happens again. October 1871, Chicago. George back with the potatoes, a good load considering this time of season. He'd stored them in a large warehouse that he rents and will be moving them out in bushels over the coming days. He tried to kiss me on his return, but I told him I was tired of that and he was to try no more. He looked like a kicked kitten, but I have to be firm. I don't have those feelings, and I can't make them appear. I might have taken a shine to him when I was only a naive young woman with no world experience, but now that I'm older, I've decided I'll never get married. How do I make him see this? He says he wants to marry me before any other man runs away with me. I always laugh, but I know he is serious. P.B. Weir, still heartbroken, says he thought it was true love. Funny how true love can see when there's money involved. October 8th, 1871, Chicago. Fire! Fire everywhere! Good Lord, pray for us. Pray that we survive. I hereby leave all my worldly goods, should any remain, to my sister, Mary Ellis, I hereby leave all my worldly goods, should any remain, to my sister Mary Ellis in Boston, which are my spare cotton and velvet dress, my small vanity case, including silver and enamel mirror, my books, which remain in my hold all, my diaries, sum of cash, the amount which I prefer not to write down, but which will also be in my hold all. My older sister Josephine Hartford is already cared for by her husband. Send word to my father, Silas Ellis, in North Sandwich, to let him know of my demise, should that be the Lord's wish. Do not let my stepmother near my remains. Theodora Mary Ellis. October 13th, 1871, Chicago. It is as a broken woman that I write now. Oh, how the world can turn in an instant. How everything that you know and take for granted can be turned on its head. Was it really only a week ago that I lived in the lap of luxury, with a bathroom near my room, with sheets on my bed, with a hot meal on the table, with fresh bread each evening? This past week has been the worst anyone has ever known, worse than anyone could have imagined. Hundreds dead, but no real way of knowing, as the flames were so hot they burned everything past ash. I could not get the roar of the fire out of my ears, or the smell of smoke from my nose. This page is full of smudges, for everything burned black. I was in my room reading before bed when I first heard the commotion. My landlady knocked on my door, and we both went out onto the street, she in her dressing gown, where we could see the great plume of fire and smoke. Never did we think it would reach us. Never did we think it could spread so far, so fast. They say it started in a barn by an Irish woman, Mrs. O'Leary, an immigrant, of course. Her cow kicked over the oil lamp when she was milking, and whoosh, up the barn went. I don't know what the true story is, but there sure is a lot of hatred towards that Irish woman now. I suspect there was more to it, for there were other fires in the days before this great fire, and the firefighters were exhausted. And why would she have been milking so late? It does not make sense to me. Oh my, how quickly the flames spread out from that barn and took their neighbor's house by house with speed. It was the wood, of course, for most of the buildings here are made of timber, were made of timber. The houses, the paths, the great hoarding, advertising, all the fancy adornments, painted wood. We could hear bells ringing and commotion, and then a great big fire engine sped past us. But it was too late by then, I think. Not a drop of rain have we had since July. A tinderbox. My landlady went inside, for she has a bad chest, and I could not help myself but move further down the street to see. A crowd had gathered to watch. "Surely it will not come this way," said one woman, and we all nodded in agreement. Surely it could not. But surely it could. Oh, how thick and choking the smoke was. When the glow of the flames crept further, we saw in horror that the fire had advanced to just a block away. It was then I realized we would have to leave. We had to get out, for if we were to live, we had to run. My landlady at first refused. This had been her home, she insisted, for 30 years. She said she would burn there if she had to, but she did not really mean it, and she changed and packed a small hold all the same as I, and we fled, joining with all the others, streaming from their houses, running at times as the crowd surged forward away from the flames. What a sorry sight we were! Children crying, women yelping, men shouting in panic. Behind us, the flames ate its way, building to building, despite the firemen and their hoses and those who ran to assist. I thought of George, who lived across the river and was surely safe. The flames could not jump across water, and so we made our way towards the bridge. He would not mind my landlady either, for she was a quiet, dour woman and would not make a fuss. But the flames did jump the river, and then they reached the gas works, and then we knew that Chicago was lost. I am so tired as I write. I have lost pounds. Smoke is a rotten smell. It permeates everything, destroys all that is left, which is not much. Some brick buildings stand like fingers. It's impossible to even know where you are, for all the landmarks are gone. They say 100,000 people have lost their homes. We have been sheltering in Lincoln Park, and we were lucky that the rain did come, for it dampened things down, but by then the fire had burned itself out. The whole city is destroyed. They say 4 miles have been burned, but when you look out across the city, it feels like more. The beautiful Palmer House Hotel, barely opened a week, gone. All that fine silk and gold brocade, chandeliers and freshly painted rooms, and all our houses. George found me in Lincoln Park to say P.B. Weir's store burned to the ground. The warehouse, too, where George had his stock, gone. Field and Leiter, where Auntie took me after my accident, also destroyed. George said Mr. Marshall Field and Levy Leiter set up a temporary shop just today on State Street between 20th and 22nd Streets in a section of the city not devoured by fire. Nobody knows what will happen, what all these poor, wretched homeless will do now. Everything will be difficult. All documents burned. So many separated. Each day more notes appear as people travel in from afar in search of their loved one, pinned to the board at the Red Cross tent. We all wear our black smudges on our faces and on our hands, our fingers charcoal, our nails filthy. I volunteered with the Red Cross and was assigned to the letter tent, where I sit and write letters all day for people who need it until my hand aches. It is hard now for me even to write this, but I suppose I must record what has been happening. Most of the letters I write are just a few short lines declaring the safety of various members of the family, but there are some terribly sad ones, from mothers declaring the presumed death of missing children, fathers, sons. So many have been lost. I am so utterly exhausted. I've never felt anything like this before. I sent a letter to Auntie and Uncle, included in the post bag of the letters I write, and a short note to Boston, but it's hard to think beyond here. All I have now is what I carry in my hold-all. I returned with my landlady to see the burnt pile of her home. She shed not a tear, which surprised me, considering she's lost everything. We must do what we can to assist. It is our duty to help others. Why God has chosen to visit this terror upon us is a hard prayer to answer, but answer it we must. We will rebuild and we will return to the city we once were. The will of the Chicago people is strong. November 1871, Chicago. George wishes to leave. I don't agree and have told him so. P.B. Weir will have the store reopened soon, but George says we can't recover here, not with the stock we've lost. I remind him that I've lost money, too. He says it's different for a woman, that it's much harder for a man to have his entire fortune erased. He had everything tied up in it, you see, whereas I kept back part of my savings. He was foolish to invest every dime he had. Any good bookkeeper will tell you that, to save some for a rainy day, or, as the case was here, for the day that everything burns. He is quite depressed. I don't think P.B. will need a bookkeeper for the moment, as he will be operating on minimal staffing and doing it himself, likely. We are all very worried. Winter has come. We are lucky to have found rooms, but they are nothing like the house I lived in with my landlady. So many remain homeless and destitute. A crisis, they're calling it. December 1871, Christmas. Everyone is afraid to light candles and oil lamps. The fire is put out early each evening with sand. The rooms we huddle in are freezing, despite all the bodies in them. Perhaps George and I have been spending too much time together, but we don't have the luxury that we once had of our own private space in our own rooms. Sometimes I have to reprimand him, for he speaks to me as though I am his wife. That is one of the reasons I fear traveling with him. It is what everyone will think, that we are married. My landlady left for New York, where she has a sister. She cried when the train pulled into the station to take her away. It was the first time I saw her tears. She said she thought she would end her days in Chicago, but now she knows it will be New York. George has a contact called Bugby, who has invited him out to work an unopened claim in a new town they are building called Elizabethtown in New Mexico. He says they're digging a ditch to bring water in from 10 miles distant and spending a lot of money on it, for they have great faith in the mine. They're building quite a town and thinks it would suit George just rightly. I don't know why George thinks he'll make a good miner, but he believes he has the skill set for it. I'm not sure that man has ever dug up anything in his whole life, but he sure is keen to start now. January 1872, Chicago. Winter so cold. We long for spring. New Mexico, beginning to sound inviting. George says the air is cleaner, the water unpolluted, and that our fortune awaits. Hands too cold to write more. March 1872, Chicago. We leave for Kansas on Tuesday by train. Last stop, Sheridan. P.B. Weir has lent George money for our transport and supplies and a small fund so that George can set himself up in the mine at New Mexico, which we will pay back once we are earning again proper. George wants me to wear a wedding ring, for he says the road is dangerous for a young woman, and in some places the Indians or bandit thieves will take a woman and sell her like a prize cow. I have told him I'll not wear a wedding ring, for I have a better idea. And then we have a clipping between chapters 11 and 12 from the Chicago Tribune, dated October 19th, 1871, which, by the way, I got myself off of microfiche at the main Chicago library when I went there earlier this year for research. Okay, the cow that kicked over the lamp. A reporter of the Tribune called upon Mrs. O'Leary of number 137 DeKovab Street, in whose barn originated the fire which destroyed the city of Chicago on last Sunday night and Monday morning. It was the intention to interview her regarding the cause of the fire and ascertain all about the cow which kicked over the lamp. She stated that this story was false. She did not go into the barn with a kerosene lamp. She did not milk at night, and she did not know how the fire started. She was asleep when the alarm was given and was awakened by her neighbor, who rapped on the door and told her that the stable was on fire. When asked how her house, which is not even scorched, was saved, she replied that there was a hydrant on each side of it, and 100 of her friends filled buckets with water and threw it on the sides and roof of the building.